Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by Gail Schimmel.
Hi Fiona, how are you doing?
Gail, I am doing okay this week, but I am second guessing myself a bit.
Is that the answer to how has your writing week been?
It is. Very often my writing week and my mental wellness are closely connected, so yes it is. As you know, I'm trying to write literary fiction at the moment. I'm trying to write a literary novel, and I'm caught between the tension of telling a story, which is always something I'm very focused on doing, and trying to write well. And what does it mean to write well? And are the two things in conflict? Just getting that story out and writing beautiful sentences.
You know, I find writing beautiful sentences is a really hard thing to sit down and do. It's like, I will now sit down and create absolute beauty. It's a hard thing. That's why I don't try to write beautiful sentences at all. I've been worrying a bit this week. Are my sentences a little bit too unbeautiful? really. But I don't know how you do it, because I've got no advice for you, because I think it's such a hard ask that it almost is the moment you start thinking about it, you can't do it.
Yes. And when I do kind of self-consciously construct this artistically perfect sentence, more often than not, when I'm reading over it, I'll go, oh my goodness, what absolute rubbish, and I'll cut it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the sad truth is that beautiful writing is something that just happens when it happens, and you can't make it happen. And the more you pursue it, the less likely you are to get it, because you're going to start writing pretentious crap.
Yes, and that is what keeps happening to me, so I need to take that lesson on board. But Gail, tell us about the sentences that you're having doubts about.
My challenge this week has been about keeping going no matter how hard it is. You know, I'm writing my 500 words a day, and I am doing it. I'm really am doing it. I'm showing up every day. But there are days where my day job has been hard, my parenting has been hard. I'm at the end of the day. The last thing I want to do is sit down and write 500 words. Mm-hmm. And I'm making myself. And I inevitably am so happy after I do it. I'm in a better headspace. I'm pleased because I've achieved this thing. Now I've achieved everything I set out to do that day. I can go to bed feeling good about my day. And I think in a way writing is like that, that you're always pleased you've done it. You've always pleased you've jumped into the cold swimming pool. But sometimes when you're standing on the edge of that cold swimming pool and you have to make yourself jump, it's really hard.
I know that feeling all too well. And what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
So I've made a decision, I don't know if I talked about this last week because I have no functioning memory, about reading better books.
Yes, you did mention it.
And one of the books that I've read in pursuit of better books, I really hope this isn't the book I talked about last week, The River is Calling by Wally Lamb.
No, this is a new one.
And this is one of the books that I have just loved this reading season as I'm seeing it. I love Wally Lamb. I've always loved Wally Lamb. He's probably most famous for I Know This Much Is True, She's Come Undone, and The Hour I First Believed. Those are the big ones. And this, The River is Calling, is about a man who he does something dreadful. Are we sure I haven't spoken about this?
Yes, I am sure that you haven't, not on this podcast.
Because I feel like I have. It's a something dreadful that I have a family experience of, this the same something dreadful having happened in my husband's family. And he does something dreadful that is basically his fault. And now he has to live with the consequences within himself, but he also goes to jail. Mm-hmm. And it's a bleak book, but it's an amazing book. I mean, Fiona, if you want to learn to write beautiful sentences in a plot, Wally Lamb, you can't look for a better example. It's really, it's not going to make you feel joyful about life, but it's going to stay with you. And it's so beautiful. And, you know, I'm not one to go seeking depression in books. I really am not. But I'm so pleased I read it. So highly, highly recommend The River is Calling by Wally Lam. What about you?
Well, also in quest of reading better books, I've been on a bit of a 19th century tear, as I think I've mentioned before.
Yes.
And my most recent one was Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, which I knew was very long book. But the thing about it is that I have never watched the musical or listened to the music or seen a movie version of it. I knew absolutely nothing about it. I went into it knowing nothing about it. And I've just finished it. It was a wonderful, wonderful reading experience. But it made me really reflect on this habit of these 19th century men of writing long digressions in the middle of their plot. They will suddenly branch off and give you 50 solid, close-written pages about the history of the Battle of Waterloo. Or just as the plot is wrapping up and finally you're going to find out what happened to these characters, we have a long digression on the sewers of Paris. Or the convents and the nuns who lived in them. That one was actually very interesting. But just that confidence to sort of go, you know what? Yes, I know I'm telling a story, but let me tell you another story.
I'm interested in this topic today. Yes, let me write about it.
Let me air my views on the Battle of Waterloo.
Fiona, do you think perhaps it's that they didn't have the many platforms we have available?
Yes.
And, you know, the book had to, that this was going to be your only voice. This was your chance to say all the things you're interested in. We can go, oh, I'll do a blog post on the sewers of Paris, or I'll do a Substack on the sewers of Paris, or I'll write a tweet about the history of whatever. But they didn't have that. They had to fit it all into the book.
Yes, I think that is. It's got a lot to do with that. And I must say that when modern writers do that, and I talked about reading Middlesex, that's a pretty hefty book. And it covers a lot of ground, but there are no actual massive digressions like that. In a way, he wouldn't dare. He knows he's got to keep the reader's attention because there are so many other things competing for your attention. And when I do read a modern book that goes off on an absolute essay about something only tangentially related, I get very irritated. And I'm fairly likely to put that book down or fling it with great force. So I think we've got less patience with that these days.
And I mean, we know our attention spans are short. So we don't want, if we wanted to read about the sewers of Paris, we would have found an article about the sewers of Paris. I do not want to read about the sewers of Paris, and I will not be reading Les Miserables on your recommendation.
It was wonderful, though, I have to say. So somebody who also writes wonderful books is our guest today. Our guest today is Anke Mazibuko. Anke is the author of two novels, both published by Penguin Random House, The Second Verse and most recently Canary. The Second Verse was nominated for the Sunday Times Literary Award and won in the youth category for the South African Literary Awards. Anke is a counseling psychologist in his day job, and we are so happy to have him here in the studio with us. Hello, Anke, and welcome.
Thank you, guys. Honored to be here and been looking forward to it since the invitation came. Thank you.
Anke, we've really been looking forward to having you in. I was on a panel with you at Kingsmead and I was fascinated by everything you had to say. So I have been looking forward to this. And we are going to jump right in and ask you, how has your writing week been?
It's actually been quite terrible, to be honest. I think that has been for most of the year. And I've had to acknowledge to myself is that, you know, my latest book was part of a PhD. And when I submitted everything, the thesis and the actual book, at the end of December, I took it for granted just how intense the past 3 years had been, with a day job and everything else that I do. And I tend to write at quite a high rate when I'm in the flow. So throughout this year, I've been kind of getting into the process and getting out of it again. And I already have a manuscript which has been given a date of publication of August next year.
Right.
And so I've been more going into that and reading it and hacking at it and then kind of working a bit on it. But that's it's more the editing process, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, Gail, from the panel we were on, I spoke about how much I edit. Like, I'll go into like up to 13, 12, even more drafts because I keep going back. But in terms of getting into the flow state, man, I miss it. It's been a long time. But I think I have to acknowledge to myself that maybe it's downtime and I just should make the most of it, perhaps, you know. So.
And when you are in that flow state, as you said, what does that look like on a daily basis?
So for me, I come from the Stephen King school of writing, where my daily target is 1,500. 500 of those can be for journaling, but 1,000 of them must be for the story I'm working on. So some days work out better than others. I might get days where I just get to the 1,000. Others I might get to like 2,000, even 4,000, depending on if I can write in the morning or in the evening. So ideally for me, with a full-time job, I get to work at like maybe 6 or 6:30. And then I'll sit there and write until the rest of the staff get there and the day starts. So in my previous job, more than 2 years ago, it was around 8:30, 9:00 that the other people would get there. This was a state-owned company. But in my current job, the day starts at 7:30. So I would usually get like an hour, 45 minutes in of writing. And then if I'm fortunate in the evening when I get home, if I have the energy, I might edit or go back to it again, and start working at it. So I'm very conscious of, how many months am I going to sit with this first draft? So if I'm producing 1,000 a day words for the novel, then I know, okay, 3 to 4 months, let's aim for that. And then if it's young adults, obviously slightly less, you know, 2 months maybe. And I kind of encourage myself not to focus on the quality of it, just the words, just get it out, you know. And then once there is a draft, then the editing can start. And I feel it's been probably one of the biggest learning curves for me to realize that for me, in my process, the writing actually starts when I start editing, rather than that first thing I put out. Because the first thing I put out can go in all sorts of directions. In fact, everything I've ever tried to write, I've tried to start as a horror story. And then it doesn't end up being that when I whittle it down to what it's actually supposed to be. But I love that thing of being able to run away and just go in any direction. And so what I start with and what I finish looks very, very different because of I just follow wherever the ideas go and put it all down.
I've got so many questions about that. I want to ask you about the journaling. So let's start there. Okay. Tell us the difference between the journaling writing.
Yes.
And the writing. Because I've read that you journal every day.
Yes. So the journaling, since 2008, I was in my mid-20s and it was a 5-year relationship had just come to an end. And I was studying psychology at the time and we're talking about these, the benefits of journaling. So I had nobody to talk to about this particular thing that was happening in my life. So I started journaling and, you know, it's been amazing because all I asked of myself is that I show up every day. And it wasn't a thing of how much do I journal. So some days it might be a paragraph. It might be an inspirational line that I come up with, you know. So I come from a background of writing poetry and rapping. So, you know, sometimes the perfect lyric that you've kind of come up with would be enough. Other days I journal like 2 pages and I go more and more and more. But I think it was the thing that kind of gave me the belief that actually this is more than just a therapeutic thing. You know, so after about 5-6 years of doing it, I started getting this idea in my head that one day possibly I could write a novel. At the beginning, I thought I'd take stuff from whatever I was journaling, but I've never taken any of it. I realize it's separate from actually producing a story. But I think in terms of a practice and getting into the habit, it's really, really helped me. So my normal day when I'm working on a manuscript is start with the journaling. And then after that, go into whatever story that I'm working on at that particular time.
That's very interesting.
So were you that child who always knew that he wanted to write, or did it come to you through this journaling process that you got the self-belief that you could one day be a writer of fiction?
The honest truth is that no, I never thought I could be a writer. And I think that's more because of lived experience, because I thought a writer was like this amazing thing that I was in awe of, like, and I still am, to be honest. But I think I was in boarding school from a very young age, and at that school, they made us read. You had to have a new book every week. And also my parents both read a lot. In fact, the room I shared with my brother was my father's library. It was like his books were everywhere. So I was always surrounded by books. I loved reading. And it was only, in high school, I used to write poetry. but I didn't think it was any good. And then when I got to university as a student for the first time, I spent more time outside of the lectures and more at like slam poetry events and hip hop events. And I thought to myself, I can do this kind of thing. And that's the first time I started writing in a very creative way outside of what was required from me at school. But I've always known that I wanted to be a creative. So when I was about six, I wanted to be a cartoonist. When I was in matric, I wanted to study fine arts, but my mother was like, not a chance. You're too academically strong to be going that way. So because of lived experiences, I didn't take creativity seriously. It didn't seem like it was a serious thing. But then when I was, after years of journaling, when I was 35, I was doing a PhD in psychology. And I realized I've got two master's degrees. I'm doing this PhD and I'm a creative. I don't know. I've done what my mother's asked of me, but I've never honored this creative process. So at the time I said to my partner, can I write you a short story for your birthday? And it was about a month or two from her birthday. And she was like, sure. And then I started writing this short story. But by the time her birthday came, I was like, this could be a story. Like, do you mind if give me more time? And then
she was like, you're not getting a birthday present.
You're not getting a birthday present. Yeah. So she was like, yeah, go ahead. And she encouraged me and I kept writing. And then I decided I'm dropping out of this PhD because actually I don't owe it to anybody except my partner. And she was like, no, I mean, do what you want. You know, your mother's not hanging over your head anymore, you know? So then I decided to drop out of that PhD to write my first novel. And that was, the second verse. And I think I was fortunate that once I'd written this messy draft, I saw on a website called Opportunities for Africans that there was a call for six writers across Africa to submit a draft of inequality to the Mawazo African Writers Institute. And mine was accepted, and Yawande Omotoso was the facilitator. So oh, for wow. 6 months, wow. There were six of us from around Africa. I was the only South African. There were two Nigerians, a Tanzanian, Zambian, and a Ugandan. We'd meet on a Monday for 3 hours online, and then she would run the sessions and cover all the basics of storytelling. And she was basically telling us that she's teaching us how to edit. And if you want to publish, you better know how to edit. So I think that was possibly the best thing that could have happened for me in this journey. And when that was done, COVID happened, and then I took a chance and sent the manuscript to the South African publishers, and Penguin responded within 2 weeks, you know, and that was the first book that was published, you know. So, yeah, I mean, so it's kind of like honoring the creative side of me, but I think I discovered it late in my life, and it was because I honestly didn't believe that what I'm writing is worthy of coming out there, you know. But I'm trying to lean my life in that direction of saying, believe more and more and more. You know, and I think even now we're speaking offline about me changing jobs. The main reason is because I'm taking my writing that seriously. And when anything threatens it, like job or whatever, then I make adjustments to not bury it anymore. You know, so yeah.
From your first novel and from what I've read about your life and from your age, you are that interesting generation of the change in school system and the change from apartheid South Africa to post-apartheid South Africa. And you're kind of caught in the crosshairs of that. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that was like and how it influenced your writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, on the one side, so I mean, I went to boarding school when I was five. It was the year I turned six. So, and I was there for 8 years. So you can imagine, you know, at that time, my family was living in the township of Mimlazi, just outside Durban. And there was a lot of protest there. And I think our parents wanted better for us, you know. So they took the chance of sending us to a boarding school in the Natal Midlands. And there, I mean, that school was, I think I was raised by hippies in that school because they promoted storytelling. And every year there was a production of Shakespeare and, you know, reading and reciting poetry were just such big things. So I think the culture of reading became an important thing. But more importantly, I think my exposure to the English language and kind of being embedded in it. And there they would openly say, do not speak your home languages here. Learn the language, speak English, get into it, you know. So it was something that I got into. And from a young age, I realized that myself and my two siblings were the only ones getting this education. So amongst our family would be the odd ones out around our, our cousins and, you know, wider family. And you become very aware of that you speak English better than you speak your mother tongue, you know, and in some places you get teased for that, you know, and that was my experience in high school, especially because then I moved from a boarding school, away from KZN to the Eastern Cape, and it was an all boys school, not very hippie like there. It was more military like, you know, and it was a big change, you know, and this was in 1996, you know, just 2 years outside of the democracy, democratic election, sorry. And I think the experience there was just this exposure to different demographics of South Africa. And I think in my personal case, it was mixed because you would imagine that, oh, okay, we've just had this transition. It's probably around racism and things like that that I had to contend with. But it was more than that. As a black kid coming from a private school, speaking English, now suddenly in the government school, and I'm now living in the suburbs, and I'm very different from the other black kids in the school, I dealt with a lot of discrimination from all sides, you know, and that kind of always made me feel like someone who's in the middle looking in, looking at all the different sides and trying to figure out what's going on here, you know. And I think even as a working adult, that kind of continued in the, because I've worked in a state-owned company where I didn't meet many people who had the kind of education I had there. And then also now working in a private school where as part of the management, there weren't many people that are like me on that management team, you know. But I think with age, kind of finding the comfort of being able to be all right in those spaces and not feel like this is not a place where I belong. If anything, I think there's a unifying quality in it because I always take people for who they are, and where they are. So now when I find myself telling stories, I do feel the sense that it's almost like I'm bridging gaps in the sense that there's a younger generations of all races and all religions that I can connect with. And then there's older generations that I can also connect with because these are the people who raised me or taught me and whatnot. But the gap between those older people and the younger people is huge. And I think it needs people that can fit in spaces, especially around identity, and help others kind of like say, no, guys, let's come together, you know. And this is where I enjoy telling stories because I feel like I'm trying to connect with different kinds of people, you know. So, for example, I might share African experiences. Like in my first book, I speak about the initiation thing of a Xhosa man, but I'm doing it in a very English voice, you know. But it doesn't mean that is not a lived experience. So it doesn't mean because it's not told in the language that it happened in or whatnot, that it's not like an authentic voice. And I think there's many people who've said to me when they've read that particular scene in that book that it's great for them to get that exposure that they otherwise wouldn't have because of language barriers or culture barriers or anything like that.
So let's talk about the second verse, because it seems to me to be, it's not a memoir, but it's inspired by your lived experience. And your protagonist, Bokang, is, it's kind of early 2000s. He also is very inspired by rapping and spoken word poetry. And I want to talk about that title, the second verse, because he has a friend who tells him that the first verse is important, but the second verse is where it really happens. And it seemed to have metaphorical applications to one's life. You know, as a teen, you think, this is it, this is life. But life is really kind of coming after that. So can you break it down for us, the meaning of that title, the second verse?
So in hip hop, especially, so when I was exposed to hip hop in the late 90s, early 2000s, we were part of what was called underground hip hop, which was seen as less commercial, but more about the message behind what you're actually saying. So it was, you know, influenced by the Black Consciousness Movement, anti-system, you know. And so in that context, what you said was very important. It was less about the beats. It was less about how flashy your words were. It was what message are you coming across with? And in that context, whenever we met on Fridays, we used to have what were called freestyle ciphers, where we all meet and then we share whatever your latest, what you've been working on in the week. It was like a writer's bench where you get there and you kind of flex to each other. And in that space, we knew that if we were recording a song, the second verse of any song had to be better than the first verse. So the first verse has to be good to draw people in, but you must know that the second verse will always have to be better. You can't drop a second verse that is weaker than the first verse. So that's kind of a concept that I liked and took into my life, especially because I'm someone who's dropped out twice in my life, you know, and I dropped out at 19 from a quantity surveying degree, of all things.
Possibly a very sensible choice.
And at the time, I dropped out to become a rapper, you know, so which didn't go particularly well. I mean, it went for 18 months and I was like, that's what I was doing. But I was very conscious at that stage that I'm taking a big risk. But once I started picking up my life again from studying psychology and working again, it felt like, okay, people need to believe that the first attempt at something, no matter how good, shouldn't be the end of it. And if it ends badly, there's still a second verse. There's still a second attempt that you can actually use or do better at using the experience of that first attempt, the first failed attempt, you know. And I think that has usually, that has been the message of my life, that whenever I try something the first time, it's not likely going to go the way I envisioned, but that doesn't mean I can give up on it and think, well, that was it. I tried. I give up, you know? And so that's what that metaphor in represents, especially because this main character is quite, the creator himself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've touched on the fact that you are a psychologist. And it's always felt to me like psychology is quite a, it's quite a good base degree for a writer.
Yes.
And a profession for a writer. It's full of ideas. I want to know how it has shaped you as a writer. Has it helped form you into the writer you are? And particularly, has it helped you write characters?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, the psychology, I almost feel blessed that I got an opportunity to do the psychology. And then also now I'm writing stories because I'm fascinated with characters. Like, and I think even first person perspective in particular, I like it a lot. And the times when I've attempted stories in third person, which I have manuscripts of, but I just notice I get so much more out of writing from first person. And it's because of that opportunity to place the reader inside the psyche of the character and just create a character that is very complex, you know. Psychology has taught me a lot in the way of, you know, how to observe people. And when you're with people, when you're listening to them, or even if you're not in conversation with them, like people you don't know in public spaces, I've learned that patience of just sitting and watching. And then I really enjoy then creating characters and thinking about some of the characters I've met in real life and how can I take elements from different people in order to create characters. So I think even if I hadn't studied psychology, I've always been fascinated by anything to do with people. Like, I love meeting people. When I dropped out in 2000 from university, I didn't have internet. I didn't have a computer at that time. So I spent a lot of time in libraries reading about astrology and palmistry and tarot and all these fascinating things, which are things that I still read about even now.
I want to ask you about those.
Yeah. So I think it's just always been this thing of, you know, in any assessment I've ever done, the top thing that I appear on is relation, like relating with people, anything to do with people. And I genuinely have a fascination with meeting people, engaging with them, getting to understand them, what makes, motivates them. And so when I studied psychology, I think that added a richer layer. And I often say to people, you know, people might come to me as a psychologist for help, but I still feel to this day that when I listen to people in a therapeutic setting, I am getting a lot about life lessons, and I love that process because it's a two-way thing. Like, I sit and think about the things that clients have taught me, and I think, how can I apply this in my life? And now, how can I apply it to the stories that I tell? You know, so I think it's just a great way to engage with people and the human experience, you know. So
I want to ask one more question about this. Is there not a danger of stealing your clients' lives, like vampiring off your clients' lives in service of the story?
I think there definitely is. And I try my best to be respectful. So, I mean, to be honest with you, if I think about the two books I've published, I wouldn't say there's any character there that is built completely on one person. Even outside of a therapeutic setting, every character that I know is built on a character I've read about, a character I've watched, a character I've met in real life. You know, there's certain stories that have left me with characters that I just can't forget. You know, like Ikey Solomon in The Potato Factory, you know, and Fagin in the Oliver Twist play, you know, and I think those two characters were based on the same kind of character, you know. And so when I think of a villain, I know I'm still going to write a villain that's very similar to that, you know. So professionally, I do have to respect the confidentiality of the client. So I doubt there's anyone who will be able to read my stories and say, hey, is this me? Is this, you know, because I try and mix it up in such a way that a person doesn't have that opportunity to say that.
I'm trying to think how I would feel if my therapist was a writer and how I would read my therapist's books if they were a writer. Like, it is quite an interesting dynamic.
What I will say is, a lot of my clients buy my books.
I'm sure.
And they come to the book launches and things. And so one of the things I learned from clients, that when I thought I was writing a particular story with the second verse, and then when people would come and give me feedback, like they'd say, how did you manage to write about such traumatic things without re-traumatizing yourself? And I think, what? I don't, you know, that wasn't my intention. But I realized that in this bodywork of the story, I do just enough to make a person think about their own story or their own situations they've been through in life. And then, and you know, like, I've had people say the second verse was actually about the dad who was an alcoholic. I've had another client come to me and say, oh, that it was terrible what happened to his little sister at the ballet recital, you know, with the father breaking the whole thing up, you know. And I find it interesting that people bring their own things to the story. And so that becomes discussion points in some of the therapeutic sessions. So some of the clients come and say, that character, just talk to me about that because I related so much with that character. And then that gave me ideas of, okay, so this is maybe where the psychology comes out in the stories, you know. And I do see the storytelling as a form of healing, that other people can engage with it and think about what they've been through. And then even if they don't get in discussion with me, but think about it and work through it. My intention with the second verse, even though it's been classified as young adult, I was past the age of 35, approaching 40, and I wanted people that age and older to reflect on their teenage years. So I found it fascinating when people were saying it's for young adults. I was like, I was writing it for adults, you know, because I want people to reflect on their past.
So let's talk about the inner life of your protagonist, Bokang. When I started reading it, you know, the opening scene is he's been called into the principal's office because he's written an essay where he has this theory that assisted suicide centers will really help society. And that got him a shortcut straight to the principal's office for a conversation where he gets misnamed by the principal and disrespected in various ways. But I immediately got strong Holden Caulfield vibes. And I later read that there was a deliberate intertextual relationship between this book and Catcher in the Rye. So were you interested in applying that kind of Catcher in the Rye narrative to a South African setting? How did that inspiration work?
Catcher in the Rye is one of the books that kind of taught me so much about not just writing, but about myself. Because when I did it as a grade 11 student in high school, I really hated it. And I hated the character. And I thought, what is wrong with this kid? This kid is so negative. I can't even, why are they forcing us to read this thing? And then some 2.5 years later, I was a dropout from university. And I found that same copy on my bookshelf at home that I'd read a few years earlier. And I remember reading it again and being blown away by how much this boy understands me. And I was like, this is me. Like, and I was fascinated by the fact of, but me just 2.5 years ago hated this, but look where I am. And then I left it on my shelf. And about 10 years later, in my 30s, I read it again. And I had a completely different appreciation of it again. And I thought, I want to write a story like this, where it's such a complex character. And, you know, there's wisdom, there's naivety, but, you know, they're not a perfect person, but you can feel something for them and they make you think about your own life. I wanted to tell a story like that. And so when I thought about my own high school experience, I realized that for the longest time, I'd considered those 4 years of high school the worst years of my life, and without actually going deep into them or talking to anyone about it. So then when I started writing the story, the story actually, as I said, was an attempt at horror. So it was supposed to be a teen story where this boy falls in love with a girl that comes from a family of werewolves. And then these werewolves are in an intergalactic battle against a reptilian species.
obviously.
That's where the story went. And so when I ended up in my first writing class, the one with Yawande Omotoso, one of the greatest pieces of advice I got there was she said, you're trying to do a lot of things here. Is this a horror story, a fantasy story, a coming of age story, a romance? You know, what are you doing here? And then I sat and thought about it that, okay, what would I like my first story to be? And I thought, coming of age. How about that? You know, let me do that. And I remember the Catcher in the Rye. And so that's when I actually started whittling it down and taking out all the unnecessary things.
All the werewolves.
The werewolves. They're going to find a way in one of the stories. And then, it became the story that it needed to be, you know, and I found that once it was published, I now speak very positively about my high school experiences. And that's where I discovered the therapeutic, nature of the stories for myself, you know. So I tend to go to painful places in my life and write about those, but in a very fictionalized way, you know, which is also a very similar thing that happened with Canary, you know, the second book. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about genre. You've kind of touched on it from horror into coming of age. And you don't seem to be feeling that you have to choose a genre and stick with it, which is something a lot of writers struggle with because we do feel pressurized into that. I'm interested in what genre you see the two books in, what genre you see yourself writing and going forward, or are those werewolves coming for us?
Those werewolves are coming for you. I'm going to keep trying this horror thing. And I think it's because two of my favorite writers, one is Stephen King.
Yes.
And the other one is John Connolly, who writes very detective-like stories with a supernatural element to them. And I think because I've gotten so much joy and fascination from those kind of stories, even in watching movies growing up, I feel like I have at least one or two stories in that genre. But what I've been fascinated by is that every story I attempt, that's what I try to do. And then when I'm editing and whittling it down, I realize, but there's a far greater human story here that I think I should focus on. And so I think a part of me maybe is writing about the horror of the human existence, you know, like from a psychological point of view, like what can we do to each other that's horrific, or what kind of horrific situation can a normal person find themselves in without there being monsters and fantasy elements and supernatural elements and things like that. So I try not to focus a lot on genre now that, I mean, if I had to try, like I say, I would try write horror. But outside of that, I think I write with more freedom if I just tell the story and then decide afterwards what this is supposed to be, because I can be a very unconventional person, I think. And when I think of the stories that I still want to write, they're probably going to be very different from the stories that I've written, but they'll probably still have that same strong character driven, the psychology of this person and whatever situation they're in, you know. So I'm not even sure what you call that, whether it's, I know the second book has been called a psychological thriller and a political thriller. Mm. And I'm like, I never thought of those things while I was writing the story, but it's interesting when they are put into those categories. But for me, I just try to tell the story and then see afterwards where it will fit and where it will land. Hopefully it's written well, and that's all that will matter.
So you decided for your second book that you were going to do it through a PhD in creative writing. Were you making up for that PhD that you dropped? Or what was your purpose in undergoing this mentoring process?
Oh, gosh. So when I dropped out of my PhD in psychology, I was certain that I would never be back in academia again or have to study. I thought I'd done enough. Now, my older sister, who passed away in 2021, she was 5 years older than me. She was my mentor in everything. Like she could see that I'm going to be a creative one day, even while my mother was telling me it's not going to happen. So she was busy with a PhD when she passed away. And a part of me felt like there's unfinished work. I need to do something to help her finish what she never got to finish, because I know how much effort she had put into it, and it just didn't feel right that it wasn't finished. Then on the other side, I was very much aware that I had always had a very strong creative side and a very strong academic side. And they seemed to be in contest with each other throughout my life. I stopped doing the one if I was pursuing one too much to do the other. And I couldn't find any kind of reconciliation. And I didn't know there was a PhD in creative writing. When I was getting out of a PhD in psychology, I tried to get into an MA in creative writing, but I couldn't get in anywhere because they said I didn't have English at an honors level. And I thought, but I've got two masters, you know, but it didn't matter. And so I thought that's not going to stop me writing a book. So I watched a lot of YouTube. I read a lot of books. I still read a lot of books on how to write, you know, because they've helped me a lot. And that helped me along the way in writing the story. And then once my first book was published, I met someone who had done an MA in creative writing and they hadn't published their first book. And they were in awe of me and I was in awe of them that they're doing the MA in creative writing. And then she mentioned to me that you can get into a PhD in creative writing without the MA, especially depending on which university you go to and how much of a portfolio you have. So when I heard that there was an opportunity to attempt to reconcile the creative and academic side of myself, I was interested to see, is this going to work? And so I signed up. And so the manuscript for Canary, I'd actually written it even before Second Verse got published.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. I had that story written, a certain version of it. But once I started the PhD, so it was a 3-year degree. In the first year, you focus on your novel. Then in the second year, you focus on your proposal. Then in the third year, you focus on the thesis. So what I immediately realized was when I started it, I tried to write a new story because that's what my supervisor said I should do. But 6 months into it, I couldn't get that manuscript of Canary out of my head. So I put that manuscript aside and then went back to Canary and started working on it. What I found fascinating is that the deeper you go into the research and you realize things, the more you go back and change things in the novel. And that was, I think, a very rewarding process, even though at the time it was frustrating because it felt like, oh, just when I thought that it was coming along, now I've just learned something new that, you know, is I can't not have it in the story. But it was such a process. Like I changed it so many times, the story, that at some stage I was so frustrated that I don't know if you remember at the panel, I said I put it aside and I rewrote the whole thing from memory. And I was like, because I wanted to see what am I getting wrong and what am I getting right. And that proved to be quite useful because it went from a manuscript of like 117,000 words to about 62,000. And I realized I was focusing on what matters in the story. And then the final thing, I think, was about 85,000 words when it eventually came out. But it was a really rewarding process in the end. But it was difficult during it because, you know, when you're writing creatively, you may flow and words come out easily. And then when you now must read articles and books and write, you have to accept 2 paragraphs a week sometimes, academic writing, and you think, oh, I'm failing. But that's the way academic writing works, unless you're that way inclined. And so when I'd feel like I'm failing on the academic side, I'd run away to the creative side and feel my confidence in there until I'm getting stuck again. And then I'm like, I'm done with this creative process. I'm trying to become a professor. And I'd go and sit with the academic side. So I kept running away from each of them. And amazingly, I think in my second year, I was so frustrated that I turned my back on both of them and decided to write just a random story. A YA story. And that's the one that's getting published next year. So it became the kind of like safety place. When I was frustrated with the PhD, I'd go play around with this story that was supposedly going nowhere. But then I realized when I submitted the PhD that, oh, I still have this story. And I was like, oh, and it's looking good, you know? So yeah, but I would encourage it for anyone who has the commitment to do it, that it's a rewarding process.
You've spoken a lot about how much you edit, and it gives me anxiety attacks because I'm a very lazy person and I don't like to edit. I want you to give us some insight into what that editing process looks like. And I'm particularly interested, how different is your first draft from your last draft? Like it sounds to have taken werewolves and intergalactic battles out. Like you've actually written a different book in your edit. Is that how it is?
It is like that. I think my story's changed drastically. And I also think it depends on the story because Like the one that's coming out next year came out, I think, a lot easier. And there was very minimal editing from a, like a story development point of view. It was more just the sentences and characters here and there. So my process, I don't like to plan too much at the beginning. So what I will do is I'll get an idea, then maybe open up a Microsoft Word document and then write down over two pages what I think is coming to me. Who's the character? What situation are they in? Where could the story possibly go? And then once I have a sense of that, there's a Excel document that I've created where I have a tab for characters, and there I'll say things like, what star sign are they? How old are they? What are three things we don't know about this character, or three secrets that they have? What is their most recent history about them? What are their physical characteristics? And what is something that they really can't stand? And then I'll just play around with that document and put all, maybe four or five characters in there. And then I'll go to a tab, which I call character arc, where I'll just put random scenes. So I'll say, okay, this character, what do I see them doing? And they don't have to be sequential. Just this person fights with a security guard. This person cheats on their partner. This person, you know, gets comforted at a supermarket or whatever, something like that. And I'll write all these random scenes. And as I'm doing that, it feels like the story is starting to come to me. And then I'll also go to a thing of relationships, like, how does this character relate to that character? How does this character relate to that character? And, you know, what are the connections there, you know? Because I do tarot reading, sometimes I'll do a tarot reading on the main characters, maybe the main one and the antagonist. And so I'll look at current circumstances. I'll look at lessons from this life cycle. I'll look at obstacles and challenges, what they expect, what they're not aware of. And then once I'm done with that, I'll go into the story and I'll just write. And then I'll start writing. And then it very often changes a lot from what I've already put down, but at least it's given me the gas or the fuel to kind of write. And then once I've spent a few months on that and I get to the end, I leave it for a few weeks and then I go back to it and then read it. And then I start plotting. And that's when now I'll do like the three scene structure, or not scene, three act structure, and put in this, you know, what I think the story should actually be. And then if there are changes that need to be done to character, then I might do them again. And then I feel my second attempt is probably when I'm writing the first draft of the real story. And then once that's done, then I go back and then I say, okay, now let me fix the plot. Then I'll spend a few weeks going to fix plot holes and all that. And then once I'm done, I go back to the beginning and say, let me fix characters. Then I go through and fix characters. Then I go back and say, let me fix dialogue. Then I go back and say, let me fix whatever I need to. But only right at the end do I start fixing sentences and things like that. Because, and by then I may have gone through close to 10 drafts by the time I get there. And a draft is me going back to the beginning every time and then fixing. And it's a, I try stick to the discipline of, if I'm fixing characters and I see something wrong with dialogue, I ignore it. Like, I'll get to dialogue. For now, just stick to character. Just keep fixing things to do with character until you get to the end. If I need to come back and do the same thing again because I'm not satisfied, I'll do it again until I come back to dialogue. And then the final draft is usually pieces taken from older drafts. Like, I might think, there's a character that I took out that I really need that character to come back. And then I'll go and get that character. Or I think I wrote that other scene better. Or that dialogue there worked a bit better. Then I'll go back and take that and fit
so,
it in.
So you're saving it all as version one, version two?
Yes.
You don't
No, I don't throw it away. No, I keep saving them as separate documents. Every time I get
that's
to the
so
end of
so interesting, because I just overwrite. Yeah. It's like that first draft never existed.
Oh, wow. No, all those skeletons are still there. And
interesting.
I feel like bits of those, should I ever publish like short stories, there's a lot of short story material sitting there. Or even these characters I've taken out of another story and put into another story because I felt I wrote that character so nicely there and I still have that material. Let me try see if it works here. And then I'll put it in there. So, yeah.
I'm just going to observe that you started out speaking saying, I don't really plan what I write, and then described a process that involves more planning than I have heard from any other writer. Excel spreadsheets, Word documents. I'm like, I need to go and have a little lie down at the level of your work.
If you see that document, you know, in my attempts to help other people write, whenever I show them those Excel documents, they say, no, they're not going to write. If this is what it takes. And I'm like, no, this is my process, guys. Your process will be different. You know, this is what makes me feel like I've got a grasp on what I'm doing, you know? So, yeah.
Well, I've got a question based on Canary, which I found so interesting, because your protagonist, who works for an arms trading company and is suddenly has all the eyes in the company trained on him as being a potential whistleblower, and he gets nicknamed Mlungu and also gets called a clever black. And those terms, especially clever black, took me back to the Twitter of sort of 7 or 8 years ago.
Yes.
When those terms were being weaponized against black people, sometimes by white people, sometimes also by black people. Can you talk us through that weaponizing of those slurs against black people and what those slurs are attempting to do?
Like I said, I worked in a state-owned company for 12 years. And in my experience there, I didn't meet many, if any, people that came from a similar background as me in terms of education, in terms of family makeup or whatnot. And so I found that in many situations, I was always someone who was different from other people. And in those circumstances, I noticed that promotion or opportunities and things came to people who are more party affiliated rather than you have the abilities or you're qualified to, you know, to progress in your position. And if you did try to, in my case, if I tried to kind of show my experience, show what I knew, it was very often that I was labeled as you trying to be a clever black or uzenza umlungu, which means you're trying to be a white person, or you've schooled too much with white people, so you think you're going to bring that kind of mentality here. Mm-hmm. And I always found it as, I mean, it was an attempt to kind of criticize me and make me feel bad and, you know, bring me down. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time it just made me drive or dig my heels in deeper and trying to change something, because I was much younger then. So I felt like I was stubborn and I was trying to prove something. And it would just make me work harder to prove people wrong rather than me sit in a corner and feel like, you know, my confidence has been knocked. But I think over a 12-year period, and especially because I was at the state-owned company when it was in the news a lot, and I had seen how it had gone from one that when I got there, I was proud to work there. You know, it was one that never needed financial bailouts from Treasury. It was independent. It did very well. But by the time I left 12 years later, it was, you know, needing bailouts. There was no money. We read in the newspapers what had been done to it. And it was heartbreaking for me as someone who had been in there, worked under different managers, watching myself work under managers that I respected, that respected me, to people that knew less than me and were there because of affiliations and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it was disheartening for me. And I think that's when I started writing Canary. Not that I myself have been a whistleblower, but I was finding myself in situations where I felt I'm questioning my own integrity. Like, is it aligned? My values, are they aligned with the companies or the people I report to? You know, what would I do if now I find myself alive in a situation where I've discovered something huge and I need to do something about it? But mainly I think I was fascinated by what happens to you as an employee psychologically when people are trying to work you out or people are trying to treat you in a way that you don't belong and we don't want you there. And I feel like you don't have to be a whistleblower to understand what a difficult work environment is like. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to capture that in the situation of a whistleblower.
Right.
You've talked a little bit about your interest in tarot and astrology and palmistry, and I find it a very interesting one because psychology is a scientific study, and these are arguably non-scientific fields. I'm very, very interested in it. Talk to us about it. I'm not sure what my question is, but talk to me about your interest and also possibly how it relates, how it's influenced your writing. That character stuff was very interesting, how you use it for the characters.
So I grew up in a family where both sides of my family practice African spirituality, which is a belief in ancestors. And there's obviously traditional rituals that need to be done. Now, my family didn't do the most traditional rituals, but I myself did go through Xhosa initiation, where you go through circumcision and you going to learning how to be a man, and you out in the mountain for like a month or so. And for me, that was a very, there was a lot of mysticism in what was happening there. And because of what I'd seen from my parents and the beliefs that they had, I always knew that these are beliefs that I also have, you know, in terms of ancestors and the afterlife and what that represents and whatnot. So because from an African point of view, my mother had always taken, not always, but from when we became teenagers, she would take us like, okay, I'm taking you to go see a sangoma. And then she'd also take us to a tea leaf reader, or she'd take us to a card reader, you know, because she was into those kind of things. So when I dropped out when I was 19 from university and I was sitting in the library, I was fascinated in all these things. And so I started reading about them. And then it was fascinating to me that I could read a book on how to read palms, and then I could look at someone's palm and start reading the person's palm. So it felt like I learned it in a very mechanical way. Like, it didn't feel like any kind of spirituality to me, because I was like, it's in a book. That's what this line, this is what that line is. That's what it means. If it's shaped like that, that's what it means.
Oh, and look, as you're showing us, you've got the sort of palms that you can see why you're interested.
Because they're so dark.
Your lines are very clearly, like, it's like an illustration from a textbook.
So, and my father used to say that's M for Mazibugo. So I was always fascinated when he'd say that, and I wanted to know, what is this? But the astrology side was, in matric, I got a heartbreak, like a unrequited love situation. And then it happened again in first year varsity. And what I remembered was both these ladies were Capricorns. And I knew my mom was a Capricorn. And I thought, what is Capricorn? What is this? You know, so it was kind of like, personal experience drew me to it. Like, I wanted to know, what is a Capricorn? Why is my mother a Capricorn? And why these two ladies like Capricorn? What is Capricorns? And then that got me into it, and I went deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And then over years of reading and getting exposed to it, I noticed that if I trusted my gut or intuition when I was doing a reading. So for example, if I'm looking at a hand and I know I've read that this line means this or means that, but something is telling me inside, rather say this, I started listening to that more and more and more. And I felt like, oh, okay, this is something that I can do. So my partner, when she discovered that I do this, she would say, do readings on me. Mm-hmm. And I would be like, no, man, this is just a hobby. I don't know if it's a real thing. And she'd be like, no, do readings on me. So every quarter she'd make me do readings on her. And then she started telling her friends, and people would come to me and they'd be like, you know, can we charge, you know, and can you charge us? And I'd be like, this is not a real thing. This is, but then I realized that my intuition, I did have an ability with it, you know. So when I was still much younger, because I was fascinated with this stuff, I thought psychology was kind of related to these things. Because in a lot of the books, they would have a section on palmistry, tarot, Reiki, and then at the end, they'd have psychology. And then when I signed up for first year psychology and I realized psychology was a science, oh, I was so disappointed. I was like, what have I done? So the first 3 years of psychology were really tough. I couldn't drop out because I'd already dropped out and I was paying for it for myself. I actually started enjoying industrial sociology more. And so when I had to choose at honors level, I almost did industrial sociology, okay. But something said to me, just go into psych honors and see this thing through. And I'm grateful I did, because from psych honors, that's when I started enjoying it. And the masters, I really enjoyed it. And so I feel like I respect psychology in the way that I practice it, and that I understand that, you know, you've got to practice it in the way that you've been trained in it. And you've also got to respect what a person is there for. So I don't bring in things that a person doesn't believe in into my practice. So I separate, if a person comes to me for a reading and they've heard through the grapevine that I do readings, then I'll do a reading for them. But if a client comes to me and says they're depressed and they're there for psychology, I don't mention anything of me doing tarot or anything like that. Because I think with having been given a license by the Health Professions Council of South Africa, I have to respect that and operate in a way that respects what my license says I can and cannot do.
Well, I feel like I could have a 2-hour conversation about this, because I think the overlap is quite interesting. I think that a very skilled, and I don't particularly believe in tarot or palmistry or astrology, but a very skilled person uses it as a,
yeah,
as a tool into the psychological conversation, and that intuition is actually picking up what the person needs to talk about.
Yeah, and I think much to my surprise, more and more of my clients are coming wanting that. Like a mixture.
I mean, I want you to read my palms right now.
I see lots of money.
I'm so interested in prologues at the moment, and your book Canary opens with your main character with a gun being held to his head, and he looks at the gun and he thinks, well, at least I'm going to be shot by a weapon that I respect. And then we go back and sort of find out how he got himself into this situation. What is the role of a prologue, and how would you advise inexperienced writers to use or not use a prologue?
Sure. Yeah. It's strange because when I read prologues, a lot of them, I feel like I'm not sure what it was there for. The ones that I've always enjoyed are the ones that, first of all, they're not long. They draw you in very quickly into some sort of action that's happening. And then later in the story, we return to that scene in some way. And the connection is made in a way that you haven't forgotten that first scene. So I think for me, the shortness of it and also the action and the fact that it's relevant to a scene that is going to be opened up further later on. When I wrote this one, I actually didn't think I was writing a prologue. So what happened was, the original structure of this book was that I wrote it like a diary. Like it was supposed to be diary entries, and they were very random. Like some of them were just scribbles. And I was trying to say to the reader, I want you to be part of this journey where you see how this person is mentally breaking down. There was a book we also did in school called Flowers for Algernon or something like that. I forgot who wrote it, but it was about an experiment done on someone who had mental limitations, and the scientist, and so the diary was written in a very slow, the person is not a very strong thinker, but as they became more intelligent in the story, because there was a scientist working on them, you could see it in the writing. And then at some stage the experiment starts going wrong, and the person starts losing their abilities, and you could see that. And it was so heartbreaking. So I was trying to write something like that, where as this character is feeling pressure and they struggling with what to do with this ethical dilemma they find themselves in, you can see it in the way it's written. But it was very hard to follow the story from people that I gave the story to, because they'd say, where are we here now? Where are we there? What are we doing? So that opening scene was a scene that I'd written, and it was later in the story. But then in the new version, when I was just grabbing pieces randomly, I thought, what would it be like if I just put this at the beginning, instead of writing a story where you don't know if this person is going to end up in a situation where their life is in danger or not. I was like, how about we start with that and we put it there, and a person knows that, okay, this person is in danger now, and see if that is enough of a kind of hook to keep a person reading to find out what actually happened in this person's life to get them to that point. So it was an experiment, you know, just to put it shortly. And I hope it worked in the way that it was intended.
I feel like I've got 100 more questions and we're running out of time. So I have to ask the question that is my question of the season. And that is, I am very interested in not how people get ideas or why you get ideas, but where you get ideas. I'm interested in where you are when your best ideas come to you.
Usually bored somehow. So I try to take a lot of walks around the block, even if it's just 20 minutes. And I find that a lot of things come to me. I go to the botanical gardens, in Marentia there quite a lot, just to walk around and be bored. I don't always get this right, but I try have a cup of tea in the mornings before I leave for work. And I find, cause it's still dark and I'm looking at the stars, I'll get these ideas and kind of like, okay. And then the ideas, I think they flesh out that 20 to 30 minutes when I'm in bed, just before I sleep. A lot happens then, which is why when I'm writing a manuscript, I try sleep early, because where I was on the page in the morning, I kind of happens naturally. It's like the subconscious just plays into it, but it's important that I'm not staying up late and I'm not watching something else. And then the story kind of unfolds. So if I got a spark of an idea early in the day, and I get to bed on time, that first 20, 30 minutes before I sleep, it feels like I'm watching the story happening, you know, and then I'm like, okay, next day, let's get to it.
And oh, wow.
Yeah.
I want that.
That's so interesting. So, Anke, what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on you?
There's a time every year when Stephen King's latest novel and John Connolly's latest novels come out, and they seem to come out around the same time. And I always stop everything I'm doing just to read those. And I feel it's less about the entertainment and more about studying them. So I recently read Stephen King's Never Flinch, and then John Connolly's The Children of Eve. And then having read those, I went and picked up It, Stephen King's It, mm-hmm. which was released mm-hmm. in 86. And I mean, this is a book that's 1,300 pages. And it's a study, because I'm not sure how a person writes a novel like that. That's not fantasy in this day. But also because I also try my best to avoid the news, but I find that where I'm getting a lot of information is from the street WhatsApp groups in my neighborhood. Yes. Yeah. Because in our neighborhood where we stay in Kensington, close to Eastgate Mall, we have a strong sense of community, and it's a very diverse community. I mean, there's even a lot of foreigners from around the world in close areas like Broomer, Cyril Dean, and even Bedford View. And so I find that following those conversations, it helps me kind of pick up the sense of the times, you know, and when neighbors are coming together in the street because something's happening. And I don't like to express my voice there. I just observe. Like, I go there and I watch the neighbors and see where's everyone, how are things doing. And I think just watching Johannesburg, like, I can't believe how many roads I'm used to driving through suddenly have holes where things are being dug up, and then it's left like that. And I think, what is happening? Like, you know, and that fascination before I went into John Connolly and Stephen King's books, if I went back like a month ago, I'm reading a lot about, blackout situations, because that's a storyline I'm curious about. Like, what would happen if Eskom was out for 8 months?
You know, collapse of the grid.
Dystopian fantasy.
Would neighbors come together, or would they turn on each other, you know? And I'm like, oh, so I'm fascinated by that. There's two books on Eskom, one that I've read, and then also survival, how to survive in these situations, you know, public management of systems. You know, I'm just curious about those things, you know. But I think just observing people in my neighborhood and conversating with them, watching the conversations, is very fascinating for me. It's like the story is writing itself in the WhatsApp groups.
Well, Anke, it sounds as though your stories don't actually write themselves. You do it very consciously. But we hope that everyone checks out The Second Verse, published by Penguin Random House, and now most recently your new release, Canary, also Penguin Random House. And we are very much looking forward to the new book next year and everything else that you have coming down the pipeline. Mm-hmm. What a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Anke. I am looking forward to the dystopian future werewolf novel.
It's coming. No, thank you very much, Fiona, and thank you, Gail. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
Gail, I got the feeling that you had a million more questions to ask Anke. I feel as though you could have just kept going.
I had so much more. He's such a multifaceted person, you know. Mm. The things when I read up about him before the interview that we never got to, like he's got a bit of a history with graffiti art, and mm-hmm. I really wanted to know about that. I wanted to know if he still does any fine art. He's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And I love it when you meet someone like that who is, it almost makes me feel like quite a one-dimensional person, but who's just has so many interests and clearly has always had so many interests. I really, really loved that.
Yes, so did I. But what did you take from it in particular?
So Fiona, I felt while we were talking like he was talking to you about mm-hmm. your beautiful sentences. And reminding us that editing, you know, you and I see editing very much as a, we will clean up this draft we have done, but we don't see it as, well, I certainly don't see it as so much part of the creative process.
Yes.
But perhaps the beautiful sentences need to happen on the second draft. Let's not call it an edit. Let's call it a second draft of the book. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's where the beautiful sentences need to happen. Maybe we should be writing bog ordinary sentences the first time around and then recrafting it the second time around. I mean, I get a bit tired thinking about it. I don't really want to be recrafting a whole book the second time around. But everything he said about editing, about the second verse, second attempt, doing things twice in life, felt a little bit like a message for you and I today.
Yes, that there are second chances on this, that your first crack at it is not necessarily the best and you do have a second chance.
Yeah, and maybe we too focused on the quick and immediate outcome and lose track of that ability. What did you take from him?
Well, I was so interested in what he said about how his first novel was originally going to involve werewolves and an intergalactic war. And I really enjoyed his first novel and his second novel. And I don't necessarily think it would have been improved by having werewolves and an intergalactic war. So it made me think about, you know, when the werewolves are knocking at the door wanting to be let in, do you let them in or don't you?
Well, first I'm going to ask you, is there any book that would be improved by werewolves having an intergalactic war?
So, fantasy, possibly.
No, so I was interested in it because I feel the allure of fantasy a bit. Werewolves I'm particularly uninterested in, as it happens. As I'm very interested in vampires.
Right.
I would love to write about vampires, but anyone who's read me knows my books don't really lend themselves to vampires. So I understand the call he's feeling. But the thing I almost wanted to say was, well, if you do let the werewolves in, don't let the intergalactic battle in. Those are two separate books.
Werewolves
should not be leaving Earth. Right. And I don't know why I feel so strongly about that. Do you let the werewolves in? I don't know. I actually don't know, because I suppose you have to ask yourself carefully, is this the book where the werewolves belong?
Yes. And I think Anke has kind of resolved it in his mind by thinking, I can still write the werewolf book. That is still an option. And that's how I got around in my 40s. I just had this burning need to write about every little thought that had ever flitted across my brain. And I thought, okay, well, I will. I'll do that. I'll write this kind of fantasy novel and that kind of superhero novel and all the things I ever thought about.
And the world is richer for it, Fiona.
I'm not convinced of that.
But
now in my 50s, I have the sense that time is not infinite. And yes, I could still get round to the werewolves, but maybe I need to start focusing on the legacy stuff, the stuff that's going to last.
Yeah, and that's so interesting, because look at how much you produced when you were following those fleeting thoughts around the place. I mean, you really, there was a point there where you were just producing, felt like a book a week, and I'm not complaining. Let me be clear, I loved them all. What is better to achieve, like that prolific output or the legacy? And I'm going to just say, I do think that those books were part of your legacy. I don't think that they were in any way lesser books, but we know that I really am a sucker for a good story over a beautiful sentence.
Well, if anybody has answers to these questions or has thought about these questions or wrestled with what to write about next, please get in touch with us. We are on all social media across the board and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.